Hello, everyone. So this presentation isn't really strongly structured. It's mostly a long list. I want to emphasize a few things before I start. One is that I really am talking more about, yes? Oh, OK. Okay, good, so that should be more audible at the back. Excellent. The focus is more on web-oriented XML languages, and in some cases, it's some of the things I say might not apply outside of this context. And also, it mostly is a shopping list, and it's not a strict set of mistakes. Some of the things that I outline as mistakes, you might think are actually the best idea that's ever been done. But at the very least, I wanted to list those things so that even if you think it's a good idea, you know that it's not the only option, and that when designing a new language, people would actually think about the alternatives. You'd think that given the volume of XML and of XML languages that are produced continuously, and the body of experience that's growing, that people would stop making some very typical mistakes, but the problem is XML is at the same time it's very simple and very flexible, and so it's very easy to hang yourself in a zillion different ways, and also there's very little that's been done in terms of education and outreach in terms of how to design a vocabulary. So basically I'll start by going through a few things. One of the first section is about namespaces, which everyone absolutely loves. The first typical mistake one can make is actually not using a namespace. Namespaces are loathed by a lot of people, and a lot of users that don't actually understand them. I actually think that namespaces are hated more than XML schema, and they do that with a much shorter specification. But they really are very useful. For one, they identify the language. And also, they permit composability so that you can use your own language inside another language. Now, you might think that you're designing a really simple language for a really simple use case, and that there's no reason to compose that language into another one. But what generally happens is that your language grows, people use it in use cases that you haven't thought of, and all of a sudden you need to mix it with something else, and then when you don't have a namespace, everything falls apart. So a lot of people tend to think that namespaces are an expert topic for some reason, but I would tend to say that if you want to not use a namespace, you actually have to be more of an expert to be sure that you won't need them. But there's a related issue of using too many namespaces. The typical example that people tend to bring up here is RDF, but RDF actually has a good reason to use many namespaces because it's extremely modular and people can create their own RDF vocabulary, so that it does lead to RDF XML documents that look like they have a lot of namespaces and actually do, but that's understandable, that there's a good reason for that. Bad reasons for that is, for instance, at some point the SVG, a few people on the SVG working group thought that SVG should just be a toolbox and every single section of the spec should get its own namespace. So for instance, you'd have a namespace for graphical elements, you'd have a namespace for transformations, you'd have a namespace for scripting and a namespace for filters. And that's perhaps nice from a theoretical point of view, but for authors who actually have to hand edit the documents, and a lot of people do that in web context, it becomes a complete nightmare because you have more namespace declarations than you actually have code in your document. So if at all avoidable, it's a good idea to avoid having too many. Now this is one of the things that not everyone agrees with, but the namespace URI should really be an HTTP URI, otherwise you don't get it. There have been some attempts to define what you can actually put at the end of that HTTP URI, and there's no complete agreement as to what it should be. But things that it should not be is probably a schema, because then what happens when you start updating a schema? What happens if you want to use another language? You might be stuck with DTDs for your entire life. And then it can get worse. You have Microsoft in XAML, who actually have their namespaces point to a DLL name that implements the code, which might sound like a good idea, but again, it brings tight coupling to your documents, and that leads to an impossibility of implementing the same language differently. And of course, you can take it to extremes. So the idea is, even if you don't put anything at the end of the HTTP URI, it's still a good idea to use one, because one day you might be able to do that, and using an RDDL document or something simpler, if we ever agree on a solution to this. That way you can point to human readable documentation, schemata, style sheets, all sorts of stuff. There's also the some specifications, I think most of them are now defunct, that figure out, oh, this namespace stuff, we don't really get it, it's too complicated, it's bizarre. So we're going to define a different way of processing namespaces using the same syntax. That really falls apart. It happened in one MPEG working group, I know, at least, and I've seen attempts to do that several times. It really is a bad idea in that, even if technically the XML specification does not define namespaces, they're defined separately, so you might think that you can do that, but then you lose the entire benefit of interoperability with pretty much the entire rest of the tool set. So you only get the XML syntax and nothing else. And also, there usually are reasons for things that people think are bizarre with namespaces. And when you try to change things, such as, for instance, the rules for namespaces applying to attributes, you get really strange things. A lot of people try to get the idea that unprefixed attributes should have the same namespace as the element, and that introduces clashes that you will not detect at the XML parsing level. One of the big problems in designing vocabularies is people who use XML schema, and I'm not going to go through a fit of XML schema bashing. We've had some of that already, and I've done that quite a lot myself. But it's wrong to use XML. It's ironic that people go through the pains of using XML, using namespaces properly, and then don't allow anyone to extend the vocabulary. It's completely ridiculous. Basically, you've built everything on top of something completely extensible, and at the end you make it not extensible at all. So part of the problem is in the tooling. XML schema certainly doesn't help, and there are good things such as NVDL, about which we heard this morning, that help lift this issue. And I certainly hope that people will consider using NVDL a lot more in the future than they have in the past. So another family of issues with XML is people forgetting that it's also intended for humans. It's not all about binary XML, even though that's very cool. So one of the things, take DocBook, for instance, just because I happened to write the paper in DocBook. Some names are difficult to read, and I could have gone through an entire list from many different languages. I just picked this one because one of the issues, if you're not a native English speaker, then the names that are stuck together are very difficult to tell apart. You don't see the boundaries of the words. And I mean, I don't know, when I see classy nopsis info, I wonder what a nopsis is that can be so classy. And then this is just that. So then you have hard to memorize names. The W3C has been very good at making it extremely difficult to remember namespaces from any language. And actually, they don't fit on the slides, but the list goes on and on and on. And if you weren't there in 99 to see the X-Link spec come out, you might think it came out in 98 for some reason. And even though, of course, those are supposed to be opaque strings, it helps people when they can actually remember them. The W3C is actually moving towards a new policy that allows for namespaces without a date in them that uses the name of the language, for instance. So that's forward-looking. But of course, they're not the only ones. I mean, Microsoft is a fairly frequent offender, and a lot of others as well, using version strings and things like that in namespaces. Another problem is people defining elements on their own without taking the context that the element appears in. So that was excusable back when people used DTDs because you couldn't create context-sensitive elements, but there's no excuse for that anymore. So for instance, in SVG, you can have a title element anywhere. So if it's in a circle, it's the title of the circle. If it's at the root of the document, then it's the title of the entire document. And you don't need to call it circle title or document title and rectangle title and things like that. But I see a lot of people creating the vocabularies, doing it element by element, and then composing them into a structure. And they tend to make that sort of mistake, which drives users crazy, because when you have to type it afterwards, you're typing circle and then circle title, duh, yeah, I know. So it annoys people a lot. This is a specific, rather technical issue, and it's a very, very, very common in designing web-oriented XML languages. People tend to think, well, there's a simple label that I want to put on this element, so I'm just going to put it in an attribute, like label attribute, title attribute, alt attribute, and it looks good because HTML does it, so it's got to be right? Well, actually, no. This is problematic for internationalization. Basically, some languages require that you can mark up the text so that you can annotate it for Ruby annotation, for instance, for Japanese and Chinese. Also, it means that you cannot add any kind of even the slightest structure. So maybe you want to talk about an interface and it needs to have a code element to make it appear different. And this breaks really fast, actually. People don't notice it in HTML because they must use the alt tag to have some semblance of accessibility because it's nowhere near enough. But one has to be really careful, and it's much better to use an element inside the element to describe the title or label or whatever. And if you really want to allow your authors to have a terse option of just using the attribute, then you can define your processing rules such that you have an attribute if you want, but you can also switch to having an element and it takes over. Some people think XML is really not for humans. This is a XAML document. It's probably the simplest XAML document you can write. It doesn't fit on the screen, but that's okay. And all this is doing is defining a rectangle of a given size at a given position with a background. And anything more complex becomes even more complex. And the one thing that's interesting here, it's not specifically to bash Microsoft, but it's because this is a very good example of people defining an XML vocabulary around a processing model, around something that is machine-oriented completely, and then telling users, well, hey, it's XML, you can edit it, it's great, use Silverlight, it's like, woo, and it doesn't work. In order to understand this, you have to understand the internal model of the .NET display system. Basically, you have to understand that the position of an object is actually a property of its canvas. That's why you have canvas.top on the rectangle. So the rectangle itself sets a property on the canvas, and then its sub-element rectangle.fill is actually as if it were an attribute of rectangle, which is why it has that name. So it's completely bizarre to edit, and users will quickly give up on trying to do anything like that. So, of course, the problem is not always with XML. It's never really with XML, but some things are more at the language definitional level. Simple example, inconsistent naming, that's from SVG. All the graphical elements are called by the full name, except rectangle, which is rect. For no reason. It's silly, but it really trips people up. Incoherent features is also something that's not specific to XML, but people tend to make that mistake because it's so easy to specify something, you know, I'll come to that afterwards. It's so easy to think that you can just add a feature to the tree. These two examples confuse most users because they think that both of these should work, but they actually don't. If you take the first SVG document, the use points to rect, and it will show the rect at the position where the use occurs. In the second case, the use references an animation, and users expect that the animation will apply at that point in the tree and will transform the G element, but that doesn't work at all. And so there's a lot of issues with cross-linking features that don't work. Lacune values is basically default values improved. These are very important when defining a language that will have multiple implementations and that will be hand-authored. Basically, the difference between the lacuna value and the default value is that a default value applies when you haven't specified something. A lacuna value applies when you haven't specified something and when you've specified something that's wrong or that the processor does not understand. So basically, instead of throwing its hands up and saying, "Woo, this is an error," the processor will actually drop the specification and use the lacuna value. The typical example is, for instance, in SVG, which has specified lacuna values in its latest version for everything. Basically, if you say fill equals, hello instead of red, the processor won't understand it, but instead of throwing up, it will just use the inherited color. So at least you get something that's coherent in its error processing across all implementations. It's basically a way of defining error processing that is also very important for versioning. Also, one of the things that people don't tend to want to worry about when they define an XML vocabulary is actually handling the XML errors themselves. Everyone has bought the Kool-Aid according to which XML is strict, and that's good, so we don't have to care about it because the parser does everything. And that's all fine and well, but you still have to define in your language in order to allow people to create interoperable implementations what those implementations have to do when the parser gives up. So for instance, if a parser parses to the end of the document and the only thing that's missing is the close tag of the root element, then you have to define whether the DOM has been loaded or not, even partially. You have to define maybe if you have to roll back the actions that you might have performed before. That's the case of SOAP, for instance. You have to check that the message is entirely well-formed before doing anything. And if there is a partial DOM, you have to define if an error is shown to the user, if the script has access to it, if a load event is dispatched, et cetera, et cetera. So you have to build on top of XML's error handling. So going forward towards more versioning-oriented issues, language-level error handling, it's really important when specifying a vocabulary to specify what processors are supposed to do when they find an element in their namespace that they don't understand or that's misplaced, or basically whatever resembles well-formed tag soup of something that you can understand but not entirely process. Because if you don't do that, you will get interoperable behavior for correct documents, but you will get a completely messy behavior for incorrect documents. And the thing is, if one processor has one type of error handling and another has a different one, but the first processor has a much larger market share, then in the error processing that they don't define, will have to be emulated by the competition in order to get to the same level and or to take over their customers. So you quickly run into the same problems that HTML has had, but instead of having them at the syntax level, you have them at the language level. And of course, the the biggest error you can make in terms of designing a language is to not have a versioning strategy at all. There will always be a version 2, always. Your little baby language might seem perfect right now, but it's going to grow, the world is going to change, you're going to need to do something else. If there's no version 2, it's probably because your language is going to die. And version 2 is not the right time to think about versioning. Version 1 is the right time to think about versioning. If you haven't thought about versioning in version 1, then you're going to be screwed for version 2. And so you really, really have to plan ahead. This time slot is way too short to go into a lengthy discussion of versioning strategies, but there are very good documents about that on the web. It's something that the TAG has worked on and produced interesting output, even though I don't think there's a final resolution on it, but there's a volume of information out there. And basically, a lot of this is not in designing the vocabulary itself, but it's more about designing the processing rules, matching the previous things that I've said about error handling, how do you treat things that you don't understand, and so on and so forth. Then we move on to the section of people being so dazzled and in love with XML that they just think that they can make an XML language and it'll work. And I'm caricaturing a little bit here, but it really does happen. And having been myself on the SVG working group for quite a while, I can tell you it happens a lot, and it can hurt you a lot because you tend to just add things and they don't really work. This one's simple. It's XML makes it so easy to just add something there that you get a lot of feedback from users saying, well, yeah, it's easy, just add a tag for it. And then magically, the feature's there because you've put it in the XML, so ooh, it's all good. For instance, in SVG, we've had a lot of people say, well, why don't you do 3D? It's easy. Every time you have X and Y coordinates, you just add a Z coordinate. You know, it's just an extra attribute, and you've got 3D. Which is slightly oversimplifying the issue, but a lot of that goes on. Then there's this whole nice family feeling of XML that there are other specs out there and you have to reuse them because really, really, it's the nice thing to do. It's the family of XML specifications. You don't want to reject the family, right? And again, this is something that SVG went through. We reused Xlink, and we're the only people who were stupid enough to reuse Xlink, apparently. I don't know, I think maybe Xprot uses it now? No, not even. Sorry? Yeah, DocBook uses Xlink, yeah. Two mistakes, you! And basically, SVG adopted Xlink thinking that everyone was going to adopt Xlink and that we could all have these nice discoverable links. And then no one adopted Xlink and we were just on our own with users going, why is it so complicated to make a link to something? Why do I need a namespace for that? It seems fairly basic for web language. Please, please drop it. So it's going to be dropped. Same thing with Smile. Smile, it seemed like, hey, yeah, let's import this. But then Smile is this huge clunky thing that you just drag into your language when all you want to do is move a rectangle from here to there, and it doesn't really fly. And it goes on, the MPEG things, it's just, well, useless. Again, versioning, I wanted to restate it. A lot of people think, well, hey, we thought about versioning in version 1, we added a version attribute on the root element. Yep, when version 2 comes along, we'll just make it 2.0, and magically the processor will know exactly what to do. That doesn't work. That really doesn't work. All it does is give you useless metadata about the version that you're in. Implementers that do 90% of the spec, as Mike was saying, for instance, this morning, what do you do? Do you do 1.8 instead of 2.0? Or it doesn't work. It really doesn't work. Then this relying on the external subset is usually a bad idea for web documents because they want to be on the web, but they also want to be offline. And if you need to fetch the external subset to give them meaning, it doesn't work. Again, this isn't a mistake that we did in SVG at some point, where the namespace was defined and defaulted in the external subset, which just threw up a world of horrors. So don't do that. And then just a few things to conclude. People putting markup in C data sections. Okay, I understand that maybe you got a schema that doesn't allow you to extend within your namespace at that point, but that's no reason. It should just be one big tree. And I thought this would go away, but 10 years in, I still see a lot of that. It's pretty scary. And then people ask if they can evaluate it in XSLT to get at the subtree and the sub-subtree, and it doesn't work. And then there's taking micro-parsing to extreme levels. This is SVG. This is actually real-world SVG. And I'm not bashing SVG, I love it, but we made some mistakes, so everyone should benefit from them. Microparsing is really great in some cases. For instance, XParse would be horrible as an XML syntax. It's really great to have it as just one string syntax. But in SVG's case, it doesn't make much sense. I mean, some people can actually edit that. I know I can, but standards languages should not be made for that kind of people. You just have to be crazy and work all day on SVG to be able to edit that. This case is a case of premature optimization. The SVG working group was convinced that if each of the commands, those are the letters that you can see, were to be an element in the DOM, then the DOM would be too big and it would be too slow, and then the file size would also grow too much. But all those things are wrong, because if you make a specialized DOM, which you have to do in an SVG implementation anyway, you can optimize the size away very easily, and gzip will compress this just as well as it would compress elements. No problem, it just eliminates the extra stuff. Plus there's binary XML. And that's it. Thank you very much. Mohamed?
So when are we going to die? Because you are saying that all the fuck, and then we are doing only that stuff in SVG, in Docbook, in everything.
It's a talk about bad stuff. I don't think those things are bad. We're not going to die. But hey, the fact that people make mistakes is really good for people who do freelance consulting. And yes, Makoto. Yes. Yes, because how is it going to help you? I mean, So the question is, using the version number as part of the namespace, and that's related to what I said about using a version attribute. It doesn't help you because you usually want version 1.1 and version 2, etc. Documents to be processes to be able to read version 1 documents. But if you start changing the namespace every time, then you won't make it possible for version 1 processes to read version 2 documents. So either you keep the version 1 in the namespace, and the namespace looks silly because everyone knows it's language version 2. Or you change the namespace and you break everything. But it doesn't really help. It's not a strong versioning strategy. The only case in which I think it works is if you're 100% sure that version 2 will break version 1. In which case you want to change the namespace. But otherwise, it's probably a bad idea, yeah. It completely depends on your use case. Some people have use cases that are very strict, and in those cases, you can have a strict understanding of versioning where you want actually to fail if you don't understand the message. That's often the case in SOAP with must understand. And you want it to fail and tell you, I fail because I don't support this feature. That's useful in reporting. But in typical web languages, a good strategy is to ignore what you don't understand. If it's a mistake, you ignore, and you have rules to process mistakes. If it's just something you don't understand in a new namespace or new attribute, you just ignore it. And you don't do anything with it for rendering. You don't render inside it. But you make that available in the DOM so that scripts can actually have access to it and fix it one way or another. That's a very short take on versioning. There's very long documents on the same, but. Successful, I don't know. I think the web language that best defines versioning is actually tiny 1.2, but then I wrote the versioning section, so I might be slightly biased. XSLT, I think, has a different use case in that it's more of a programming language it is a programming language. So when you're programming something, you tend to want to know basically, either fail immediately if you don't support this, or just run it. So I think for XSLT it works because you don't want to give an XSLT 2 style sheet to an XSLT 1 processor and have it run just 80% of the style sheet. It probably doesn't work. Yeah, there's that.
I have a spec where version 1 did think about versioning and wrote a lot of rules about port compatibility.
But people didn't.
And when we came to look at the quality of implementation of those rules, we found bugs in every single processor.
Yeah.
Basically, because errors in the implementation of the port compatibility wouldn't be revealed in the field because no one was using it until version 2 came out.
Right, yeah. I think that issue is part of XSLT being a programming language, so people are not going to use things or try to use things that are not defined in the standard, whereas in HTML and SVG it's very common that people will start to type in random elements and hope that they work, and then leave them there. And browsers and implementations have to deal with it.
Okay, so the last very brief question is,
you said XSLT is not the same use case, but what about SLFO?
So the question is, XSLT is not the same use case. What about XSLFO? I think XSLFO has a use case that's pretty close to that of HTML and SVG and other web languages. But I haven't looked at the versioning strategy in FO, so I really don't know. At the same time, it's for print, so I don't know if you want it to skip a chapter if it doesn't understand the chapter. Could be an issue.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.